Take your mark and put it at Daniel chapter 3. Daniel 3, we'll be spending most of our time in this first section looking at Daniel chapter 3. We'll flip it other places later on. This will allow you to get back to it and as we continue to use it as the text. Daniel chapter 3, the world that we live in pretty much expects us to kind of follow suit. As far as fashions go, as far as trends go, it's not enough that the world takes on these attributes. But if others don't follow with them, there's going to be pressure that's put. There's going to be shaming that's done. And we've all experienced that. If we stand by our convictions about divorce or about homosexuality or about any numerous topic, we're going to be looked at as, you're not very loving. You're not very accepting, etc. And so there's this shaming that takes place. It takes resolve to stand against that. And that's what I want to look at today, are the things that it takes, the necessities that it takes to take a stand when nobody else seems to be doing that very thing. In Daniel chapter 3, we have example of those who did that very thing. You remember, you're familiar with the fiery furnace, and this is a familiar text, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're going to look at them not as a character study and not as just breaking the chapter down. We are familiar with this. We're just going to use it as the launching point to look at some examples of the things that we need to have like they had in order to stand, even if we're standing alone. There was great pressure. I mentioned our culture is going to pressure us. Well, there was a lot of pressure in Babylon for those captives. It's just think, first of all, you are a captive. You're in a foreign land. You are a long way from home. And archaeology has shown us that Babylon had hundreds of deities that they worshipped. It was a very polytheistic society. And so here you are in all this conquered state and the pressure to bow, the pressure to conform, the pressure to follow along with them. And so let's just remind ourselves of what happened. In verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. The old King James says height was 60 cubits. The breadth of it was 6 cubits. To us, that's 90 feet tall. So think about a 9-story building. I don't know that anything in Corbin would even be that high. Maybe there is, but there won't be many. 90 feet tall, 90 feet, the base of it, or 9 feet rather is a base, 90 feet in the air, 9 stories tall basically. The text itself doesn't say this. It seems to be that this was Nebuchadnezzar maybe even deifying himself. This wasn't just a statue. It wasn't just something that was to be bowed to. It was the idea of recognizing his greatness. And in verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar sent and he gathered the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, counselors, sheriffs, all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This is a big deal. It isn't just that they built it. It's not just that it's going to be bowed to, but he gets everybody there. All the rulers, all of anybody of any importance, they have all been brought in. This is a huge thing that's being done here. And in verse 6, there's nothing flexible about it. In verse 5, at the time you hear the cornet, the flute, the harp, and it makes this long list of instruments. When you hear all this, you will fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will that same hour be cast in the midst of a blazing fiery furnace. So there's nothing optional about this. There's nothing here that has any kind of flexibility. It's not something you can later on say, well, yeah, well, I didn't mean it that way. When you hear whatever it was, it was understood that there's going to be this noise. There's going to be these sounds that go forward. When you hear that, that's when it's time to bow. And you would have seen 90 feet.
You'd have seen it from wherever you were. If you're in the town, if you're in the city, you could have turned to it and it would have stuck out. When you hear it, wherever you are, that's when it's time to bow. That's when you recognize the great Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar, to think of the pressure. I talked earlier about, you know, our culture can pressure us. But our culture doesn't have a king. And our culture doesn't, not only was he not a king, or Nebuchadnezzar was the king, but he's a despot. He is especially to these Jewish guys, he's a conqueror. So think about all the things he was. But now bring it in even more personal. He's not just their conqueror. He is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's employer. They were a part of that initial group of captives that we read about back in chapter 1. They were some of those, you know, bright, shiny stars of the Jewish young, and they got brought over before everybody else. They work in and around the palace. They're not out in the fields. They're not out sleeping in a tent at best, and under the stars and moon at worst. They're not out in the rain. So he's their employer. He's, I guess you could say, their benefactor. He's the one that's kind of given them some blessings because of where they work and where they live. He will be the one in the future that will determine whether or not they're going to get promotions. So there's a lot to lose, is the point. This is a king, but he's not exactly a benevolent king. He's a conqueror who is now in position of determining how well their life is. And let's not be blind to verse 6. He also literally holds their hand. In his hand, he holds their life. Here's what I have declared. Here's what you will do. And if you don't do it, you will die before the sun goes down. And then in verse 12. Well, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they don't do it. They have learned. No, there is one God. And his name is Jehovah. And they learned from that Mount Sinai on, you don't bow to any other God. You don't bow to idols. And they have learned that. They live their life by those principles. And so they don't do it. In verse 7, therefore at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, all those kinds of music, all the people, all the nations, plural, Babylon didn't just conquer Judah. It conquered others too. All the nations, all the languages, they fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the trumpet is blown, the stuff is done, and people from all over, all those conquered ones, they do exactly as they were told. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do not. And in time, people recognize that. Verse 12, some of those leaders go to Nebuchadnezzar and say, look, we got to tell you something. You might not know this, but verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. I'm not sure we can call that a necessary inference, but it might be, it could be very well an inference. Maybe some of these Babylonians don't like that these Jewish boys had worked their way up. Maybe they don't like that some of these captives have kind of made their way up into positions of authority in the palace itself. You set them over the affairs of the province. Well, let me tell you about them. You handpicked them. You hand chose them. But these men, O king, they have not regarded you. They do not serve our gods, nor worship the golden image which you set up. Now, you might not know this, but some of those golden boys you got, they're ignoring your command. They're ignoring your warning, snuffing their face at it. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't respond well. Verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar in rage and fury. You've heard the phrase, it's good to be the king. Very, very few times, if at all, are you going to see a king like this just be rejected. Probably not used to people telling him no, is the point. In a rage, he commanded them to bring him. And in verse 14, it's kind of an interesting phrase that he uses. Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said unto them, is it true? And that you do not worship my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Is it true? It seems to me that Nebuchadnezzar is almost in shock. Did I hear right? Is it true what they are telling me? Again, he's not used to being told no. When he says jump, people jump. And did I hear right? Is it really true that you've rejected what I said? It's almost like he thought, it's as if he had been misinformed. He didn't handle that very well either. And he does throw them into the fire. We know how this all ends. But just as we've reminded ourselves of the story, how much guts did that take? How much courage did that take? But there's more involved in it than that. There's character traits and personality traits that we've got to see for them to take this stand with death being on the line. And so let's talk about the fact that they had an answer. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. What does it take? What are the necessities that is required for me and you to take a stand like those three guys took? I hope it impresses us. I hope we don't let, because it's been labeled as a somewhat a kid's story. You know, that's what we teach the kids downstairs. If we can't see applications for us in the conviction that it took for them to do what they've done, we're not looking very hard. Don't think of this as a kid's story. Don't think of this as a courage story. And me and you got to have it too. What can we know about them in order to take a stand like they have? Well, we know they had some understanding that goes beyond just what came out of the king's office. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, familiar text. Sanctify the Lord God in your heart. Set Him out is the point. Elevate Him. Sanctify Him in your hearts. Be ready always to give an answer to everyone that asks you for a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. And we kind of think of that, and we've kind of converted that to, you know, I've got to give people an answer for why I believe what I believe. Yeah, that's right. But other passages are teaching us that. I need to have an answer for why my morals are what. Yes, that's right. But you know, that's not what this text says. We get that from other places. What this text says is, give an answer. Give a reason. Give an explanation for the hope that we have. We have a lot of hopes in the spiritual realm. Hopes of life beyond this. Hopes that get us through the trials and the disappointments when life is not all that great. And why do we have that hope? That's what we have to have an answer for. That's what this text specifically referring to. And so here's those three Jewish guys looking death smack in the face. And yet they still had hope. We'll go back and we'll see their answer in just a little bit. But if we have answers for life beyond this, that'll help us stand. When the mind is established, and that's their mind was established. When the mind is established, the heart will be firm. And when the heart is firm, our actions can follow. These three guys didn't decide in that moment what they were going to do. No, they decided that a long, long time ago. We saw them back. We didn't go back and mention it, but we were introduced to them back in chapter 1 when they had already made a stand against what they had been commanded to do concerning certain foods and drinks or whatever. This wasn't a one-time thing for them. And they didn't decide spur of the moment how to respond. They had come to an understanding prior that Jehovah is the only God. That Jehovah is the only one to be worshipped. And when life was put on the line, that didn't change what they already knew. That didn't change where their hope was already based in. And so here's just some real questions for us. Do we know why we believe what we believe? Do we know why we trust? Do we know why we worship as we do? Do we know why we let God's word regulate our lives? Because if we do not, we're going to bow to something a lot less than some 90-foot statue. And we're going to bow, not because some trumpets begin to sound. We're going to bow because we just start blending in. If we don't know what we know, if we don't know what we need to know, if we don't know why, if we don't have sound reasonings for that, we won't make stands. That, and me and you can look back in our life when we weren't very strong. And we can look at the times we did not stand. And that was times when God's answers and God's will, it did not mean much to us. Either in the moment or in maybe because it's just decisions we had made. But we've got to have answers. We've got to live by those answers. There's got to be some sincerity. Look in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Sometimes it's easier to stand than others. Would we admit to that? Sometimes it's easier. Which means sometimes it's hard. We're looking at the times that it's hard. Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, that was a hard time. There was life on the line. It's only a sincere conviction that's going to stand against the fiery things. We can all stand when it's easy. You're familiar with what we just call a lean-to. You go out, maybe you got a barn or you've got some little shed, and then you go and you put a couple posts up and you kind of slant something off. A lean-to is what we call it. Because literally, it's kind of just leaning. It's not really attached very well. And our religion, our spiritual life's got to be more than just some lean-to thing. There's got to be a foundation to it. There's got to be something solid. And that's where sincerity comes into. And here's the thing that we have to infer about Daniel chapter 3. Where are the other Jewish captives? The trumpets were blown. The harps were played. The strings were strummed. Bow down. And three did not. At least that's the three that's recorded for us. Where's the rest? We don't want to make things up, but it seems that apparently maybe some of the other peers did bow down because they're not there with those three. And here's where we can come to the life of Paul. It's easy to stand sometimes. These three were standing by themselves. And there was a time when Paul did the same thing. Look in 2 Timothy 4. This is the last paragraph of the last writings we have recorded. And so here he is remembering something. In verse 16, at my first answer, that's the first time I went and stood before Caesar. At my first answer, no man stood with me. Nobody took my part. All forsook me. They deserted me. I pray God may that it might not be laid to their charge. He said, remember, the first time he went to Rome, that the church met him before he ever got there. They kind of walked into town with him. He gets put in what we call that house arrest phase that lasted several years. But in time, he does go. And he does stand before Caesar. But apparently, they're not with him by that point. Because Caesar is Caesar. And he had life and death in his hands too. And the church kind of pulls back. It says they deserted him. And here's Paul in the last paragraph remembering that. Verse 17, however, the Lord stood with me. Did we not catch that idea with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They know what the rule is. They know what the law is. They know what the government position is. And they stand with the Lord. Verse 17, notwithstanding the Lord stood with me. And he strengthened me. Verse 18, the Lord will deliver me from every evil work. He'll preserve me into his heavenly kingdom. And the point is, I hope we all stand together. I hope that none of us ever have to stand alone. But the reality is, sometimes we might have to. Paul had to. Those three Jewish guys had to. And so it's going to take conviction to do that. Go back to Daniel 3. I want you to look at their statement. Look at from their own mouth how they phrased it. Should the day ever come that we have to stand alone, and that includes against our family, we have to stand alone. And that includes because our brethren have let us down. It's necessary that we're willing to do that. Look in Daniel chapter 3 this time. Look at their response. We're going to start in verse 16. And remember, this left off with, is it true? Did I really hear right? You're not doing what I told everybody to do. Verse 16, Daniel 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to him, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer you in this matter. We're not going to tiptoe. We're not going to try to walk around on glass. We don't have anything to hide. There's nothing to say. There's nothing to water this down with. We are not going to be careful about this answer. Verse 17, if it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto you, O king, that we will not serve your gods. We will not worship the golden image which you have set up. I hope we love these people. I hope we love them. Is it true? Let us just tell you blankly. Let us just tell you without any kind of hiding or watering it down. We're not going to be careful about this. We serve a God that if he chooses, he can deliver us from that burning fire. Now, we don't know if he will or not. We don't know what his will is on this. But if he chooses to, he can. And if he chooses not to, we're still not going to violate what he said. We're still not going to violate and worship something that would become idolatrous to us, and now we are no longer faithful to him. What are we seeing? We're seeing them accept the consequences. We're seeing them accept the trial. And they're recognizing we may lose in the short term, but our gain would be for eternity. I don't know how old these guys are at this point. We know in chapter 1, Daniel's a really hard book to put into chronology. Now, there are chapters where it seems like decades have passed, so I don't know how young they are. We know they are young in chapter 1. We know they are young when there was the stance made against the food issues. And so let's just pause real quick and let's just throw this out. Even when they were young, they made these decisions. They had answers, they had reasons, and they had a conviction about them. Is it too much to ask that our young be moral? Our culture wants us to be in, and they're going to want your kids to be in. They're going to want them to remember that was our introduction. They want us to conform, and there's going to be pressure put on. Is it too much to ask our young people to be moral like God requires of us? Is it too much to ask our young people to be modest like God requires? These guys willing to die against a government law. We don't even want our kids being pressured by norms and by trends. Shame on us. Our kids can be as faithful as God expects of them. Sometimes we just don't require that. We just brush it off as rites of passage and as fitting in. And oh, I sure don't want them to miss out on the dance. It takes conviction to stand out. And these three guys did that. What's a necessity? There's going to have to be some seeing beyond our eyes. We're going to have to look into eternity. Look in Acts chapter 7. What Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were able to do, they were able to see the invisible. They saw beyond the threat. Even today, we look back and we read Daniel 3 and that fiery furnace would scare us to death. And we look back with awe and respect about those that were able to stand against it and to risk being thrown in it. Well, the reason they were able to do that is because they saw beyond the fire. They saw beyond what would happen to them fleshly. Acts chapter 7, example of that. I didn't read in... I think we skipped that particular verse. But in the verse between when Nebuchadnezzar says, is it true? And after, we're not going to be gentle with this answer. We're not going to do it. It talks about Nebuchadnezzar's face changed. Yeah, he was so full of rage. When Stephen gets through preaching, look in verse 54. When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart and they grinded on him with their teeth. Their face changed too. They don't like what they heard any better than Nebuchadnezzar liked what he had heard. And you know what happens to Stephen. He's taken out of town, taken out of the city, and they begin to stone him. He is being publicly executed. He's being killed. Pick up in verse 55. He, being full of the Holy Spirit, looked up steadfastly into heaven, and he saw the glory of God. He saw Jesus standing on the right hand of God, and he said, "Behold, I see heavens open and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God." The only time we read about Jesus standing, we read, the Hebrew writer makes note of it, of him sitting at the right hand of God because the work is done. He reigns. Here's the only time we ever see Jesus standing after that, after he takes his place as king. And so can we see that as like a standing ovation? Do we see that as a father about to receive a faithful, convicted servant? And so Stephen got to see that. We won't get to see that literally like that. But can we see it? Can we see Jesus in heaven? Like apparently those three guys could. Could we see the Lord? Could we see beyond the pain of the day? Should we live long enough that the United States is conquered? Should we live long enough? You know, imagine things happen and countries get conquered. We know this world, it was mentioned in our last week, not this world's going to melt. This world's not going to continue on. And the United States is not going to just continue on. Can we not imagine? Like other nations, one day we get conquered? Should it happen in our lifetime? We have a conquering force. Al-Qaeda takes over, or put your name there, and we're the ones threatened. We're the ones who now have to bow before a foreign god, a foreign deity, or it's us that's on the chopping block. What if we, like those guys, had reached a place of kind of some comfort? We have been chosen and we work in the palace. We're not out in the fields. We're not working as slaves would work. We've got a kind of a cushiony life. There's some comfort there. Would we still stand? That's going to depend on what we see. We live a good life. And we do live a comfort. And we do somewhat live in palaces. Let's just, you know, that song we sing, "I'm satisfied with just a cottage below." Let's stop. We don't live in cottages. We live in nice places. And our life is nice. And we know that we've got things laid up for tomorrow. Are we going to let that keep us from having eyes toward eternity? Because we're not going to stand very well if we do. If it's only in this world that we have hope and comfort, then what have we got when the threats come and the persecution comes and the trials come? I guess the question is, are we content to be a part of what the politicians, I'm not sure if it's still a present day phrase or not, but you remember back when the politicians had the phrase, the silent majority. We just want to be the silent majority. We want to be silent when we're expected to take a stand. We don't become Christians so that we turn into 007. And we're not a spy. No, people are supposed to know who we are. They're supposed to know what we are. And it takes conviction to do that. And here's the scary thing. Our idols, a lot bigger than this thing that Nebuchadnezzar built. Pride and jealousy and lack of contentment and immorality and lust of flesh, lust of the eyes. Those are a lot taller than 90 feet tall. They are giants. They are ever present. And they are not just in one Babylonian city. They are everywhere we go. We take them with us. Turn back to Daniel 3. Well, look how this ends for them. You know how the story ends. They are not burned up. They are protected. Nebuchadnezzar comes the next day and we need to take notice of their God. And God begins to be praised because of this. And it's interesting in verse 30, of chapter 3, the king promoted them in the province. They actually got a promotion. They prospered. I think it's the way the newer translations use that. And we will too, in time. Look in the last passage, look in 1 Peter chapter 1. Just want to look at a phrase that maybe has a little bit more thrust to it today after thinking back to this furnace. And because of their faith, because of their conviction, because of their hope that was acted on, they actually got promoted. They got elevated. Greater things happened in their life. Look in 1 Peter chapter 1. Start with me in verse 6. The trials of your faith, whatever those trials are, the trials of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ, whom having not seen, we love, in whom though now you seek it, you see him not, you believe, you rejoice with unspeakable joy and glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. He talks about these fiery trials. He talks about these things that are hard and they are pressing and it takes courage and conviction to stand against them. He said that's what leads to the salvation of the soul. We can be blessed just as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were. They endured and they were blessed because of it. Get your songbooks out. We sing the song sometimes. I'm not ashamed to own my Lord. That's where those three guys were. Apparently, even some of their compatriots were bowing to the pressure. We're not ashamed. We will not be careful how we answer you. We have no shame about this. We will not bow. Let us take that courage with us. Let us, as we go through our fiery trials, symbolically, from now on, let's make the determination we'll stand. And we'll have the same conviction that they had. We'll not be ashamed of anything that he says. Anybody needs to respond, do it while we stand and sing.